Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to this podcast ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Fall of Rome. As always, I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Today, I'll be joined, for the first time on this show, by a special guest. He's the Dickison Professor in the Humanities, a professor of history and classics at Stanford University, the author of a great many books, most recently The Great Leveler, Violence, and the History of Inequality from the Stone Age to the 21st Century, which I highly recommend to any and all. Professor Walter Scheidel, thank you very much for joining me today.
Well, thanks for having me.
So you've been doing really excellent work on a variety of fields of Roman history for a long time now, on everything from demography to mobility to the economy, beyond. And there's a lot that we could talk about on that front. I'm really especially struck by your broad reading, wide-ranging interests, and your comparative methods, all of which I think more historians kind of benefit from. But today, we're going to focus on your next project, and it's a doozy that I'm really, really excited to talk about. So it's called Escape from Rome, The Death of an Empire and the Birth of the Modern West. I'm Patrick Wyman, and this is The Fall of Rome. So tell me if I have this right, but the basic argument that you're making here is that there was no comprehensive empire in Western Europe after the fall of the Roman Empire, and that this was a root cause of what historians call the Great Divergence, the economic and political rise of Northwest Europe to global dominance.
That would be my argument in a nutshell. And it's really that the contrast between ancient and post-Roman Europe is really quite striking, right? You have the Roman Empire that controls not only a large part of Europe physically, but in as much as we can estimate, about 80%, 4 in 5 people in Europe at the time, are subjects of the Roman Empire. And there is no state afterwards that manages to control more than maybe 1 in 5 people, 20% of all Europeans, for the next 1,500 years. So there's a real break at the end of the Roman period in the 5th century AD. And if you compare this to other parts of the world, China, South Asia, Middle East, pattern is very different. Once you get an empire, those empires tend to fall apart, just like the Roman Empire fell apart, but they always tend to come back one way or another. Not the same empires, but political entities on a similar scale.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting point that you're making there. So Rome was the only empire to do this in Western Europe, but if Rome was the only true empire along those lines to emerge in Europe, how did it come about in the first place, and how did it manage to last if the conditions, the kind of underlying conditions, were so ill-suited to sustaining it and other similar entities?
Well, that's the real question, because you can look at this from two different angles. Either the Romans did something really well, and that accounts for their unique success, or everybody else afterwards did something really wrong, right? And that's why they didn't manage to build up a large imperial state. And we can't really decide which one it was a priori. So you have to look at both questions side by side. The first one, why were the Romans so successful? Well, we do have a sense of how the Romans managed to build an empire in this space, but it really hadn't been an empire before, especially if you look at the European parts of the Roman Empire. Of course, there had been a long imperial tradition in the Middle East, in Egypt and Syria and those places, but not really anywhere in Europe, not even in Greece, where you used to have city-states. The very short answer seems to be you need a combination of two factors that need to come together in just the right way. You need an imperial core, a metropole, that is capable of projecting power very successfully and co-opting other people on a grand scale in the long term. At the same time, you need a periphery. You need other people, other polities, other societies that are susceptible to integration, to incorporation, to imperial domination. If you only have one of those two things, you're not going to end up with a large or lasting empire. And it so happened that in the Roman case, both of these conditions were met in really quite striking ways.
Yeah, the thing that's always been really striking to me, and this is, to quote one of my old professors, Clifford Ando, who wrote a fantastic book on exactly why the Roman Empire managed to convince so many people to buy into what it was doing, that the real intriguing thing about Rome wasn't that it fell, it was that it lasted for so long, that it got so many different people in different ways coming from so many different political, social, cultural traditions to buy into the kind of overarching theme of what it was trying to do.
That's true, although it'll probably be a little more reductive. I would put more emphasis on the formative stages of the Roman Empire, the Republic, where the Romans faced less diversity, I mean, operating primarily within the Italian peninsula initially. And I think it is what happened there in the 4th and 3rd centuries BC that really turned out to be decisive, because what the Romans are able to do is they don't only establish control of a few million people, there are other cases in Western Eurasia where similar accomplishments were made, but they are able to mobilize those people in a very intense fashion. So they can draw on an almost unlimited a pool of loyal, committed military manpower. And at the end of the day, unless you enjoy some kind of military advantage, you're not going to be able to create an empire in the first place. And only then, once you've set it up, do you get to worry about how do you hold everything together, right? Mm-hmm. But that's a really essential first step. And here the Romans did an extremely good job compared to everybody else out there in Western Eurasia at the time. Because there were really only two types of neighbors, if you will. You had large imperial states, the Hellenistic kingdoms in the east. They were very large, but their mobilization potential was much lower. So they couldn't translate size to equivalent military power. And on the other hand, in parts of Europe, you had groups of very high mobilization capacity, but they were small in scale because they were tribes or chiefdoms or city-states, and so they couldn't scale up in the same way as the Romans did. So the Romans, in that sense, got it just right, and nobody else could really challenge them in this respect.
So that's a really interesting point. Essentially, you're saying that by roughly the end of the Second Punic War, the Romans had reached a demographic and institutional point of critical mass, that after that point, everything else was more or less in place for them to expand throughout the rest of the Mediterranean world.
That's right. One thing I want to emphasize in my next book is really the role of counterfactuals. There are sometimes, you know, people look at them funny. They say, well, why should we think about how things could have turned out differently? Because, well, these different things didn't really happen. We should focus on what did actually happen. But that strikes me as really intellectually impoverishing, because unless we try to think a little harder about what would it have taken for things to turn out differently, unless we do that, we don't really have any hope of understanding causation. And so one of the questions is, was there any point at which the Romans could still have failed in their imperial project? And as you say, by the time you get to something like the Second Punic War at the end of the 3rd century BC, the die is pretty much cast. I mean, there are no credible counterfactuals, minimal rewrites of actual history that would have produced a significantly different outcome. It's really, you know, the death of Alexander the Great. Once Alexander the Great dies young, there's no longer any chance of the Macedonians conquering the Western Mediterranean basin as well. And after that, even with Hannibal, I'm actually quite skeptical whether there was any real juncture where things could have turned out differently, because the Romans had already built up such a position of preeminence.
Yeah, the demographic and institutional backgrounds of the Roman state by the time they were fighting Hannibal were orders of magnitude more complex and better able to harness resources than the Carthaginian state ever could.
That seems to be the case. Not that we know that much about the Carthaginians, but that seems to be true.
Yeah. So, okay, so let's fast forward a few hundred years here. The Roman Empire, over the course of the 5th century or so, and based on your work, it seems like you do believe that the Roman Empire actually fell, that's actually a thing that
happened. Oh, absolutely,
yeah.
It's not just a transformation, it's an actual fall. Yeah.
Okay, that is so refreshing to hear, because I've gotten yelled at by a couple of late antique historians for putting too much emphasis on that. But, okay, it's refreshing to hear I'm not the only one who still thinks that the Empire actually fell. But so, we fast forward to this point. The Roman Empire could potentially have returned, but it never did. I mean, at what points could it, if we're engaging in the business of counterfactuals, at what points could it have returned?
So the challenge is to identify junctures at which one could more or less plausibly argue it might have been possible for some state, for some power, either within Europe or from the outside, to unify Europe in pretty much the same way as the Romans did, by, say, ruling 80% of all people in Europe, or at least a large majority of Europeans. And if you look at all of post-Roman history between 500 and 1800, you find maybe seven at most of these junctures. And, you know, I can take you through them if you want to hear about this.
Let's pick your favorites.
Yeah. Well, my favorite, I mean, obviously the early ones are the most promising ones. You have Justinian's attempt to restore the Roman Empire, and he's half successful in the middle of the 6th century. The East Romans recapture the old heartland, Italy, Tunisia, a slice of southern Spain. That's about it. They don't really go into the remainder of the Iberian Peninsula. They have no hope of somehow subduing the Franks in what used to be Gaul, but they are reasonably successful given the amount of time and effort they spend on this. But at the same time, they're really doomed because they face a conflict on multiple fronts, the resurgent Persian Empire, the Sassanians in the east, to overcome their internal instabilities at just that time when the Byzantines focus all their resources on the west. The plague comes in, arguably destabilizing governmental institutions. There are new Germans like the Lombards waiting to move into Italy. And if you add all these things up, even before the Arabs appear on the scene in the 7th century, it's not terribly likely that any kind of plausible rewrite of history would have led to the East Romans reunifying and maintaining something like the Roman Empire.
Yeah, I mean, even ideologically, by the 520s, it seems fairly clear that people were aware that the Western Empire had fallen and that whatever they were doing, whatever Justinian was doing, was reconquest, not simply reestablishing something that had fallen out of disuse, so to speak.
That's right. Yeah.
In terms of the mental structures through which people were viewing politics and what had once been the Western Empire, I always think that's what's so jarring about the Gothic War and the documents that come out of the Ostrogothic Kingdom, like the Variae, is they were aware by that point, had been forced to become aware that there had actually been a rupture, that things had actually passed some sort of tipping point. And that was kind of, feels like it was hard for people to deal with that. And once they were forced to deal with that, the chances of reestablishing the Roman Empire were immeasurably less after that point.
Yeah, that's true. And so I guess after that, your biggest hope is foreign management, right? Foreign leadership, external invaders coming in. The early, the Muslim invaders, the first caliphate, the Umayyad dynasty, that's a pretty, on paper, that looks like a promising candidate. You look at any map of the first caliphate, it stretches from Spain all the way into Pakistan. It looks really imposing on a map. It's physically very large, but was terribly decentralized and disorganized almost from the beginning within. So it wasn't really all that surprising that they never managed to knock out Constantinople. I guess they had a fighting chance of knocking out what remained of the Byzantine or the East Roman Empire. But again, there are no really plausible counterfactuals that have the Arabs expanding much beyond Iberia. And it turns out they were pretty lucky to even take over the Iberian Peninsula. It's largely due to the Visigothic state having been in trouble for quite some time. So France, Italy, those places seem to have been beyond their reach. And almost immediately after conquering Spain, the whole caliphate starts splintering anyway. Spain breaks away, Morocco breaks away, Tunisia breaks away, and on their own, the Muslims in North Africa or Spain had no hope whatsoever of conquering Latin Christendom, right? Christian Europe. It takes them about 100 years to conquer all of Sicily, and Sicily isn't very large. So that's almost as soon as this possibility appears, it vanishes and never really returns.
Yeah, so after that, you have the Umayyads never really came all that close. And after that, you have the next one would be Charlemagne, right? And so Charlemagne
comes
fairly close.
Yeah, you have European contenders. You have Charlemagne, who is, of course, the first Roman emperor in the West, courtesy of the Pope. And again, you look at the map, his empire is not like the Roman Empire. It's pretty sizable, right? It's France and Belgium and a slice of Spain and half of Italy and bits of Germany and so on. It's not too bad. And this is a launch pad for further expansion into Spain, into southern Italy, into the Balkans, potentially. But of course, what happens is he dies. Kingdom is split up among his heirs. There's a very powerful trend underneath of increasing aristocratic power, autonomy, powerful dukes, counts, eventually knights in their castles, a great deal of effective political fragmentation. And those are trends that those Frankish or later German rulers really didn't quite know how to manage, how to handle. And if you can't maintain a reasonably centralized state, you're just not going to build up a very large empire.
So I kind of want to take a step back from that and ask a related question. So one of the things that's always really striking about the Roman world, when you compare it to the Umayyad world or to the Carolingian world or anything that comes after it, is the degree of economic integration that the Romans had managed to accomplish. And it seems like, mm-hmm. I mean, I would make this argument both to non-specialists and to specialists, that once the effective economic unity of the Roman world had been broken, that the political institutions went right along with that, that the two were intertwined and went hand in hand, and that when the economic unity went, so too was the political unity, and it wasn't coming back. I mean, what do you think about that?
That seems to be the case. So you could even say, well, the economic system, especially the system of interregional trade and exchange, depended on political unity, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. The idea being that trade really capitalizes on coerced flows of resources, collection of taxes, rich people living in the capital drawing on the resources somewhere else. And once political unity disappears, these economic connections fade as well. Not overnight, but eventually. And then you have a double whammy, right? You no longer have political unity, and you don't have the economic interconnectivity. And if you're really unlucky, as people seem to have been at the time, there may have been a degree of environmental stress as well. If you think of the plague killing lots of people, you have climatic instability. That's really a big deal if you live in Western Europe, because it's more difficult to farm the land. If all these things come together all at once, conditions are just not very favorable. They're not conducive to rebuilding something as ambitious as the Roman Empire.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So after Charlemagne, is there any chance in the high or late Middle Ages to build something like that? Or do we have to wait until the early modern period to get anything that comes close to having the potential to rebuild a state on the scale of the Roman Empire?
So before I started this project, I thought maybe the Mongols are a credible candidate, because again, you look at the Chinggisids, Genghis Khan and his successors, they do something totally amazing, right? They create the physically largest empire in history prior to the British Empire in the early 20th century. It's really, really large, at least in terms of territory. It stretches from the Pacific all the way into Central Europe. And arguably, maybe it would have been possible for the Mongols in the middle of the 13th century to push more decisively into Europe. And in fact, if you look at the literature, you often encounter this kind of sentiment, the idea being the one thing that saved Europe was just a year after they had made their first push into Europe, into Poland, into Hungary, had defeated any number of European armies very easily, it seems. The great Khan Ugedai back home in Mongolia died, and so they had to retreat because the leadership wanted to participate in the election of the next leader. So that's the standard story that's already in European sources at the time. But once you look at this in more detail, there are any number of reasons for doubting that even the Mongols, fearsome as they were at the time, could have pulled this off. There simply wasn't enough grassland in Europe outside Hungary. And even people have measured this. If you look at the amount of pasturage available in Hungary, you could only have supported a relatively small number of Mongol warriors. They had multiple horses for each warrior full-time. It's a far cry of what you get in Mongolia and both in Ukraine and the same whole step. More generally, Mongols apparently in Europe had a really hard time dealing with stone castles, which had just become really common in this particular period as a result of warfare within Europe. And they had better targets to attack. They could go south into the Middle East. Those were wealthy societies. They hadn't managed to conquer India. There were other targets closer to home that were arguably more promising, and I think that really explains why the Mongols never really came back. So even once a new Khan had been established, they never renewed this kind of push. And arguably, had they tried, they might not have been as successful as they were closer to home, for instance, when they took over all of China eventually.
Well, and at some point, the lack of kind of overarching, centralizing imperial institutions becomes an explanation in itself, right? That the Mongols elsewhere were so brilliant at insinuating themselves into the structures and institutions of politics and governance that already existed. You know, they took over existing tax systems. They displaced in other places whatever the ruling dynasty was in Persia, and simply slotted themselves into what was already there with a healthy dose of kind of steppe institutions along with that. But in an already fragmented political environment like Western Europe, where the only real overarching institutions are, I guess, long distance merchants and the church, that doesn't leave a whole lot of room into which the Mongols could have slotted themselves, even if they had dealt with the problems of logistics and everything else that went along with that.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. So I guess Europe would have been a good target for raiding, mm-hmm. right? If they had reached, I don't know, the cities of Northern Italy or Flanders or Paris even, maybe they could have plundered a few wealthy cities. But it's very hard to see how, in the absence of pre-existing political unity and all institutions you just mentioned, they would have either wanted to stay, or had they wanted, how they would have been able to stay in the long term. They would have had to do all the state building themselves, and that's not a business the Mongols were into really at the time.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So if we're up to the early modern period, and we have no emerging empire to take the place of Rome, why do we get these empires elsewhere over and over and over again, but not in Europe? What are the conditions elsewhere that lend themselves to recurrent empire building that don't exist in Europe?
That's a very good question. So the classic case, of course, is China, where if you look at the eastern half of China today, it covers essentially the same territory as the first empire did 2,200 years ago. It doesn't mean that there has been a continuous empire for 2,200 years, but there has been a series of empires, right, with different Chinese dynasties. And for a considerable part of the last 2,200 years, most of the core of China is more or less unified under a single government, or at most split into two large competing states. So that's, in a way, the counterpoint to Europe. Europe is at one end of the spectrum. East Asia is at the other end of the spectrum. And so the question becomes, well, are there any systematic differences between Europe and China that would allow us to figure out how this contrast came to be? And there are many different ways of looking at this. Of course, often scholars tend to prioritize not just a written record, but what we might call belief systems or ideology, right? The idea being there are ideas out there, especially at the elite level, that pushed political development in a certain direction. I'm a historical materialist, I must admit, so I've always been very skeptical of this. There is no doubt that there's a very powerful unifying elite ideology in China that goes back a very long time. Well, the property, the educated elite seems to subscribe wholesale to the idea there can't only be a single state, a single emperor. We all have to work for this central authority, also in order to benefit from this kind of service, that's very deeply entrenched. But the question is really, well, what's the chicken and what's the egg in this case, right? Does this ideology drive political development, or is it some kind of epiphenomenon? Is it actually created and reinforced by the fact that China is unified so frequently? And I tend to believe we should probably put more emphasis on the second explanation. So I would probably look more at ecological or geographical factors. There are certain features that make that create conditions in East Asia and in northern China in particular that seem to favor the creation of very large states. One is the proximity to the Central Asian Eurasian steppe that I just talked about, where the Mongols moved up and down, or east-west, rather. That goes back really far in Chinese history, and it seems, and this is not limited to China. A friend of mine, Peter Turchin, who is a biologist turned evolutionary historian, has looked at all the pre-colonial empires in the world or in the old world that covered at least 1 million square kilometers. And there are about 70 to 80 of those. And almost all of them were created right along the frontier zone between the Eurasian steppe and the sedentary agricultural societies farther south, in northern China, in northwestern India or Pakistan, it is now Iran, that sort of thing. And even in Europe, the largest Eastern Europe, the really large states, Kiev, Lithuania, Poland, and then, of course, Russia, were created right in that zone. And, of course, there are lots of steppe empires, too, right? Nomadic confederations that are built up on the other side. And they're really locked in some kind of symbiotic relationship with these large societies to the south. There's a fair amount of mutual antagonism, not just warfare, there's trade in a number of contacts, but more often than that, warfare, where the people in the sedentary zone really have to pool their resources to try and knock out the nomads, and the nomads try to extract resources from people who farm the land, have cities, produce a large surplus, and then try to actually move in and conquer them and rule them directly. So it's a constant back and forth for over 2,000 years, if you look at the history of this particular part of the old world. And so if you look at sort of ultimate levels of causation, there seems to be a really significant driving force behind large-scale state formation. And that sort of explains in part, not everything, but contributes to an explanation of why empire is so resilient in China, because it usually comes out of northern China, not southern China, which is striking. Big empires in India are invariably created pretty far north. There are no comparable entities in South China and Southeast Asia, in places that are farther removed, or most famously in Europe, right? As I said earlier, when we talked about the Mongols, other than Hungary and Wallachia, I mean, there isn't, the steppe doesn't extend very far into Europe proper, and certainly not into Western Europe. And so Europe used to be quite shielded in a way, and that in turn may have made this kind of lasting political polycentrism, this being locked into internal inner European conflict, that made this kind of situation possible and sustained it in the long term.
I mean, that makes a ton of sense. Like, that all makes a ton of sense. And so this brings us around finally to the kind of grand finale of where this all leads, is the Great Divergence. So first of all, what exactly is the Great Divergence?
Well, there are, in a sense, there are two divergences. one is, which is the lesser one, well, it's also important, is a divergence in terms of just military power. There's a wonderful book by Phil Hoffman that I would certainly recommend to all your listeners, Why Did Europe Conquer the World? And his argument is very similar to mine, but he focuses on the military domain. He says, why was it possible for Europeans to go out and conquer, quite literally, most of the world in the modern period? By 1900, Europeans controlled more than 80% of the land surface of the entire globe. That's a very strange kind of outcome, because Europe isn't all that big, right? And it wasn't all that well organized for a long time. The answer is, well, they were very good at fighting, especially at using fire. firearms, and they become very good at using firearms because of this intense fragmentation and ongoing conflict and heavy investment in warfare of Europeans fighting other Europeans. So that's a kind of divergence between Europe and the rest of the world. But what is ordinarily understood as the great divergence is the fact that from about 200 years ago, people in northwestern Europe in particular, England initially and then other parts of that region, and then of course later North America, start pulling away significantly from everybody else in the world in terms of economic output, of per capita productivity, that these Western societies simply become much richer, much more capable in those terms than anybody else, overtaking earlier champions like China. In particular. And that, of course, interacts with the military superiority and really, well, creates the world we live in now. If this hadn't happened, if the Industrial Revolution hadn't occurred for the first time in that particular region, the world today would look very, very differently from the way it does. And of course, there have been legions of historians, economists, political scientists, you name it, trying to explain this, to come up with some kind of bundle of variables or factors that would account for this divergence, because it really is a divergence. There wasn't all that much difference ultimately in terms of economic capacity between different parts of the globe, especially within the new the old world. And it's a really breakaway kind of process that starts with modern economic growth and industrialization. And that's what we are trying to explain.
Yeah, and so there are a couple of different ways of looking at this. There are historians who focus on an early Great Divergence who think that basically by 1500, give or take 50 years, depending on exactly who you're reading, the conditions for the Great Divergence had already been set. And then there are others who would point to a later Great Divergence and really point to the kickoff of the Industrial Revolution as that point. Depends on the metrics you're choosing, depends on what exactly you think is important. But which side do you lean toward? Do you think that by 1500 we're pretty much set for the Great Divergence, or do you think, you know, thinking counterfactually as you've done so well here, do you think it could have been later?
Well, the argument of my book is, and this may sound a little strange, it doesn't really matter all that much. And I think that's probably a strength of my thesis, because I honestly think it's really difficult to decide, because as you say, it depends on the metrics you're looking at. If you think institutional factors, cultural factors are important, you obviously have to go back longer in time. Mm-hmm. If you think it's resources coming in from the new world are important, then it's a more recent kind of development. It really depends on what you prioritize. And even if all these economic historians can't agree amongst each other, I'm not sure I'm in a position to decide. Mm-hmm. But my argument is that no matter what, if you take all the various theories out there, the ones that privilege trade, that privilege the input of the new world, that privilege institutional diversity, cultural factors, any number of things, every single one of those theories is logically predicated on the absence of universal empire in Europe itself. The argument being, had there been something on the scale of the Roman Empire in Europe later on, especially in the more recent past, things like Industrial Revolution in Britain would probably not have happened in the same way or not happened at all for a number of specific reasons. And so my job at the end of the book is to tie all this together and make a reasonably compelling case that this is the right way of looking at things.
Well, I mean, I think you've made a pretty dang compelling case. I think that you're absolutely right. And I wish that historians in general were more encouraged to think in terms of counterfactuals, because clearly that's been a productive method for you here in laying all of this out. You know, like as you mentioned at the beginning, that for the most part, we're taught to focus on what happened, how do we explain that, and not so much on what might have happened. But this is a really useful analytical tool for you. It's a really useful analytical method.
That's true, because every time I make a claim about causation, I say A happened because of B, I implicitly say, well, A did not happen because of C, right? Mm-hmm. And then I have to ask myself, well, what if C had been more important or different? And yeah, what outcomes have been different or not? So it's a very valuable way of really qualifying established assumptions. There are a lot of established assumptions out there because, you know, people in different fields tend to prioritize different approaches, different types of evidence, and so on. And counterfactuals really help us sort of becoming a little more detached, taking a step back, looking at our assumptions more critically.
It's fantastic. I'm very much looking forward to reading this book when it comes out. And when it does come out, I would very much like to have you on again to chat about it in a little more depth and detail, if that's all right with you.
That would be fun, yeah.
Yeah. Well, so thank you very much for your time today. Again, I cannot recommend highly enough Professor Scheidel's last book, The Great Leveler, which is something that will probably come up over the course of this show again. It certainly will come up in the next show that I'm doing. So again, thank you very much for your time. This has been an absolute pleasure chatting with you.
Same here. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.